In the case, I will call the conference call of the Washington State Fish and Wildlife Commission to order. It is 2:02 on Friday, January the 12th, 2018. I'd like to start off by doing a commission roll call, please. This is Larry Carpenter.
Brad Smith.
Kim Farmer.
Barbara Baker.
Jay Oldfeller.
Bob Kehoe.
Don McIsaac.
Okay, you got all those, Tammy?
Yes, sir, I do.
Just waiting on Jay Keeney, hopefully.
I'll try to connect.
I think it would be worth saying here that the listeners will be joining in, and we're going to keep hearing those beeping somewhat regularly. Those that are listening currently, the audio recording of this conference call is being taped and will be available on our website sometime this afternoon, I believe. Is that correct, Tammy?
That is correct, hopefully by 5 o'clock.
Okay. I would encourage the commissioners, when possible, to please put your phones on mute. Excuse me, because I think we're probably going to have some outside noises here occasionally. Ron, would you like to introduce the Ron Warren? Introduce the staff on site at the NRB in Olympia.
Thank you, Commissioner Carpenter. I have Director Unsworth is with me. I have Kyle Addicks. I have two public affairs folks, Michelle Dunlop and Darren Friedel, Aaron Dufault, Bill Twite, and from the AG's office, I have Michael Grossman.
Thank you, Ron. I'd like to start off with opening it up with if there's any commissioners that have any opening statements or questions that they want to bring up before we go to the initial agenda item.
This is Commissioner Keeney, just letting you know I joined.
Welcome, Jay.
Thank you.
Commissioner McIsaac, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yes, go ahead, Don.
Yeah, just not so much a question, but a procedural matter of, as we go through this, how does it relate to what we have scheduled for January 19th in Ridgefield? And so maybe some members of the public are wondering how this integrates as well. So my understanding is that we've got 2 hours here today for a briefing, and that there would not be public testimony here today, and that we would hope that there'd be time for questions from the commissioners to understand this more, but there'd be no decision making here today. When we move to Ridgefield next Friday, there's an open session where the briefing would continue, and maybe this session here today, looks like we've got a significant PowerPoint here that certainly in my mind will probably will not only help quite a bit, but might stimulate a few more questions. So an extended briefing on Friday the 19th, an open session that I think is currently noticed not to have any public testimony. Then we have an executive session that's open to things like ongoing litigation. The USV Washington matter is associated with this one, and so there may be some legal questions that occur during that executive session. The title of that one says, "And Possible Decision." Well, I guess it would be possible for some decision-making to be made in that open session. I was hoping that we would have the opportunity to ask some legal questions directly associated with this matter in the closed session. The agenda does not show the commission coming back into session after the executive session, but it's my understanding that that is possible. And when we talk about a possible decision, possible direction to the staff, possible conclusionary statements by the commission, that that is a stronger possibility of occurring then. It may be that there isn't a session after that and there's not one listed, but procedurally, it's my understanding from talking to staff that it is allowed and it doesn't need to be put in the agenda But anyway, just to kind of frame how this flows through between now and what's been on the agenda on January 19th, that's my understanding, and just wondered if staff or anybody else has any different perspective of how this might flow.
Any follow-up thoughts or questions on Commissioner McIsaac's comments? Okay.
Hey, Larry.
Hearing none, I guess we're all in agreement with that scenario. I had an earlier discussion today with Ron Warren, head of the fish program, and I had asked him to start off this briefing with some discussion around the Stillaguamish River issue, because that's kind of forefront on most people's minds. So, Ron, take it away, please.
Thank you, Commissioner Carpenter. For those on the phone from the public as well as our commissioners, we're going to jump around just a little bit to accommodate that request. Kyle Addix is going to be presenting, and as well as our AG Grossman. But I just wanted to let you know we'll do our best to, one, let folks know where we are in the presentation so that they can follow along by page number. And Commissioner Carpenter, I'll be working with you to try to keep track of time to allow us to hopefully hear maybe what the commission would like as a deeper dive into information for the 19th presentation. So with that, I'd ask your permission to turn it over to Kyle Addix.
Yeah, Ron, this is Larry Carpenter. I just have one question. I probably should know this. The PowerPoint that we're looking at, is that going to be available to the public, or what is the status of that?
Thanks for that question, Commissioner Carpenter. That PowerPoint is available online right now, so people can go grab that and follow along if they haven't already. On our main page, talks about today's commission conference call, and from there, there's a link inside the page that clicks to that people can go download that rather quickly if they're in a position where they've got a phone and a computer, so they could follow along.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks, Commissioner Carpenter. I will jump into the presentation. I'll start on what's numbered slide 2, which is just an overview of the things we hope to walk you through today. Background on the Puget Sound Chinook ESA listing and past ESA authorizations, an update on the USB Washington mediation process, an overview of our past Puget Sound Chinook harvest plans, the challenges we're facing with ESA plans for 2018 and beyond, and then a summary of the long-term plan that we submitted to NOAA last month, and that'll be heavy to details on the Stillaguamish management objectives. So based on the request this morning to sort of jump into Stillaguamish up front, I will jump to slide 28 in the presentation. Hopefully people had a chance to jump to slide 28. It's just a brief summary of the 2018 plan. That plan was submitted to cover fisheries for 10 years from 2019 to 2028. The structure of the plan was very similar to our past long-term plans. There's sort of a body of the plan that includes chapters covering background on the fisheries and jurisdictions that affect Puget Sound Chinook, a chapter on population structure and aggregation for management. I'll get into some detail on that when we back up to the previous materials. And then the next two chapters, the management objectives and implementation, are really the heart of what the plan means for fisheries and various stocks. And then there's chapters on conservative management and monitoring and assessment. The appendices of the plan, which is actually by page numbers, most of the plan contains the management unit profiles, and those are the watershed by watershed overviews of habitat issues, hatchery production, stock data and status, and the actual descriptions of the management objectives for each stock. Moving to slide 29, there's some notable changes in the plan that was submitted from past plans. One is that there were points of instability identified for several stocks. So these are escapement levels that we just want to avoid going below. So the idea is if we're predicting an escapement lower than that point of instability, it's also called a lower bound at places in the plan, we might take more severe fishery actions than what's outlined in the management objectives, but that would be a sort of look at the situation that year, trends with the population, that sort of thing, and decide what additional actions we might take. There are also total ER ceilings implemented for Snohomish and Stillaguamish management units. This one's a little bit difficult to describe, but in past plans, we've identified total exploitation rate ceilings. Those ceilings cover all fisheries from Alaska to Puget Sound. In some cases, northern fisheries take a significant portion of that total exploitation rate. So in past plans, we've identified sort of a minimum number that we would reduce southern U.S. fisheries to in spite of what northern fisheries might do. So we might actually exceed that total RER. In this plan for Snohomish and Stillaguamish, it says we will not exceed those totals, even if northern fisheries are larger, and it means more severe constraints on southern U.S. fisheries.
Kyle, could you identify for the audience what you mean by northern fisheries for those that might not know?
It's fisheries in Alaska and British Columbia, where the impacts on our stocks vary by stock, but it's fisheries north of the Washington border, the U.S.-Canada border.
Thank you.
The plan identifies escapement goals for some of the Central Sound watersheds, Puyallup, White, Green, and Lake Washington. So the intent is to manage for, to ensure that we get a set number of fish on the spawning grounds, even if it results in higher exploitation rates on those populations. And then finally, the plan specifies southern U.S. exploitation rate ceilings that vary by abundance for Stillaguamish natural origin and hatchery origin Chinook.
This is Commissioner Thorvin. Before you leave that page, the first bullet, points of instability, well, what exactly do you mean by that, that the escapement is wildly variable year by year, or what exactly are you talking about there?
It's a low escapement number. That there's concern that if we drop below that, that the population will just sort of destabilize, that it won't be able to recover from declining to an abundance that small. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So I'm just going to sort of skip over page 30, slide 30 for now. It's actually the management objectives for all of the populations in Puget Sound. We might come back to this later, but I'm going to skip that and jump to slide 31, which gets into Stillaguamish Chinook. So this is just some background on the Stillaguamish management unit and populations. There are two populations of Chinook in the watershed. There's a summer population, which primarily spawns in the North Fork, and a fall population that primarily spawns in the South Fork. Some of the analysis NOAA has done shows that the South Fork population natural origin escapement has declined over the last 10 years, that the population's in critical status, meaning it's below the critical escapement threshold NOAA has identified, and it's averaged around 100 spawners. The North Fork population showed stable natural origin escapement over the last 10 years, and it's actually above its rebuilding threshold on average. The rebuilding threshold, as NOAA defines it, is essentially their estimate of maximum sustained yield for that population under current conditions. And then NOAA did work calculating rebuilding exploitation rates for both populations. This was covered earlier in the part we skipped over, but the rebuilding exploitation rate is essentially the maximum rate that the populations can withstand from fisheries that doesn't jeopardize its chances of rebuilding.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
This is Barbara Baker asking Kyle a question. Is there any difference between the North Fork and the South Fork fish aside from the fact of where they spawn?
They're genetically distinct, and their run timing is different. That's why one's referenced as a summer population and one is a fall population. They aren't both restricted only to the North Fork and South Fork. There's overlap, but they are genetically distinct populations.
Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
Yes, Commissioner McIsaac. On the matter of the North Fork summer Chinook population, you said being stable. Somewhere in here it talks about biologically significant declines and this. So you may get to this answer a little bit later, but this, there's a 24% exploitation rate and I think an 18% exploitation rate. We've heard a lot about the Stillaguamish Chinook being in an extreme conservation mode. So are you only talking about the South Fork population as the one that's going to be so limiting in all the impacts because the other one is stable, or am I missing something there?
So the South Fork is definitely in a worse status than the North Fork. I mean, it's at really low abundances. You referenced the 24% and 18%. The 18% is reflective of the population being less productive and closer to possibly extinction. The North Fork's definitely in better shape, but it's still not at high abundances. It's been exceeding what NOAA's calculated as the maximum sustained yield escapement on average, but it's still a relatively low number. I mean, that MSY estimate is relatively small. So ideally, we'd like to see both populations back up at higher abundances.
Okay, so but when we hear things like Puget Sound Chinook stocks have declined by 40%, the Stillaguamish summer Chinook population is not in that category then, right?
It hasn't shown that decline over the past 10 years. It's definitely down from historic abundances, but there'll be a table later on in the presentation that sort of goes through stock by stock for Puget Sound and shows where there have been declines, where there have been increases, and where things have been closer to stable.
Thank you.
So there are definitely habitat issues in the Stillaguamish watershed. Low summer river flows, high winter river flows, and sediment load are all negatively affecting production of the populations. And there are conflicting views on the productivity of the populations and on what the benefit is of increasing escapement at lower abundances to try to decrease the risk to the populations. Moving on to slide 32, this is just a summary of the hatchery supplementation programs on the Stillaguamish. There are two programs, one for the summer Chinook, one for fall Chinook. The summer Chinook program on the North Fork operates at Harvey Creek and White Horse Ponds. The incubation and initial rearing happens at Harvey Creek, then final rearing and release occurs at White Horse. That program has operated since the mid-80s with the target release of 220,000 sub-yearlings per year. And it's a conservation program. It's not a harvest program. It's meant to boost numbers of the stock and reduce the risk of extinction of that population. The releases are adipose clipped and coated wire tags as they're used as a Pacific Salmon Commission indicator stock so that we can monitor harvest distribution for Stillaguamish Chinook. The South Fork Fall Program is at Brenner Creek Hatchery. It's a much newer program operating since 2007, and it's actually a captive brood program. So juveniles were collected from the wild and raised to adults for spawning. It has a 200,000 sub-yearling release goal, but because of the small size of the population, it's going to take a while to build that up. So it's been averaging 35,000 per year in recent years. And those releases are also adipose clipped and coated wire tagged for development as a PSC indicator stock. Currently, all of our fishery modeling assumes that the harvest distribution for these two stocks with different timing are the same, but we want to be able to tell if that's true or are these fish impacted differently in different areas. Moving on to slide 33. The management objectives proposed for Stillaguamish make it likely that it will be one of the most constraining stocks under the new plan. The level of the fishery constraints will depend on the abundance, so at lower abundances, fishery constraints would be tighter. The lower tier exploitation rate ceiling is 8% for southern U.S. fisheries on natural origin Stillaguamish Chinook and 12% on hatchery origin Stillaguamish Chinook. As abundance gets to higher levels, the allowable SUR, the allowable Southern U.S. exploitation rates increase to 13% on natural origin fish, and the limit on hatchery origin exploitation is removed. So there's no limit on hatchery origin exploitation rate at higher abundances. The limits that are in the plan for hatchery origin impacts are reflective of the importance of the hatchery conservation programs to spawning escapement, particularly at lower abundances. So when we have low returns, these hatchery fish returning are a very important part of natural spawning. And there may be options for increasing hatchery productions and for altering the marking to both increase escapement of hatchery fish and limit the effect of the hatchery origin exploitation rate limit.
Kyle, this is Larry Carpenter. Can you give us some review of how we got to, where the 8% came from? How was that derived? Was that, just tell me how it was done, if you would.
So I think we're starting to get into that on the next slide, 34.
Okay, that's fine, yep.
Before we leave this slide, Commissioner Thorburn, again, so is there, when you say lower abundance and higher abundance, are those actual numbers?
They are. It is based on what our predicted return of Stiligwamish Chinook in a given year is. And again, that we're suffering a little bit from jumping around the presentation, but there are some tables at the end of the PDF file, and table three in that file is the actual abundance thresholds and exploitation rate limits for Stiligwamish. So you can see what the actual numbers of fish and the corresponding rates are.
Okay, thank you.
So on to slide 34, the low abundance exploitation rate limit of 8% is actually slightly above the most recent postseason estimates of exploitation rates on natural origin Stiligwamish Chinook in southern U.S. fisheries. So when we look back at the most recent 5 or 6 years where we have estimates for what the impact of southern U.S. fisheries was, the average is below the 8%. When we flip over and look at our preseason plans for the last 5 or so years, the expected rates on Stiligwamish Chinook in those years has ranged from 10 to 15%, so a good bit higher than what our postseason estimates have told us. As we develop fisheries each year through north of Falcon, we have to plan the fisheries to meet those objectives pre-season. So we would have to plan to meet 8%. What that means is we have to do a better job of modeling accurate predictions for all of our fisheries. So we've had fisheries modeled for a variety of reasons that wind up not taking what was modeled pre-season. So managing under this regime, we would have to do a much better job of planning fisheries and modeling fisheries pre-season to accurately predict the expected outcomes.
Commissioner McIsaac, question.
Go ahead, Don.
So when you say that we've been pre-season looking at 10 to 15, and we've actually achieved 8 on average, and there's a variety of other concerns of why didn't it come in at 10 to 15? Why did it come in under 8? Does this get into impacts needed for hatchery coho target fisheries or incidental impacts for other fisheries and those stocks happen to be weak? Or is it the pattern of kind of conservative management that's always been out there? If you treat a If you have a ceiling, if you have a quota that's a ceiling you don't want to exceed, you always come in under the, most of the time you come in under the ceiling, and so mathematically you're always going to have an average underneath your preseason ceiling, or those preseason targets, or anyway, could you elaborate a little bit about why it is that these fisheries came in at 8% when they were authorized under ESA to be at the 10 to 15% level?
Thanks, Commissioner. It's a combination of factors. Some of it is fisheries that are planned, that are modeled as a number that will not be exceeded when the likely catch in that fishery is something much lower. There are other issues that are more complicated when we have different aid structures than were predicted, just different combinations of abundances of different stocks. That can affect the pre versus post look, but some of it is just modeling fisheries at higher levels than what the likely outcomes are.
Okay, and is there an incidental impact of these fish that are needed for either a sport fishery, coho, hatchery-only fishery, or a commercial fishery to fish for chum or sockeye or pinks? Is that a significant portion of this 8%?
It is not, and that's actually kind of a good segue to the next few slides. So slide 35 just tells you that you do have some tables at the end of the presentation. The third one I already referenced, it shows the management of thresholds for Stiligwamish. The first two tables actually show the distribution of harvest of unmarked and marked Stiligwamish fish based on fisheries as we plan them pre-season for the last 5 years. So in the slideshow on slide 36, I've just taken the top portion of table one, and I'll try to walk you through this. I should also point out, for those of you that might not be familiar with all of our catch areas, the last page in the presentation is a map of the marine catch areas we use for fishery management. So what this table is, are the projected exploitation rates on Stiligwamish Chinook with fisheries as we plan them pre-season in each of those years from 2013 through 2017. There's also an average column that just shows you what the average of those 5 years are. So when we're looking at where impacts on Stiligwamish Chinook are, the number one by exploitation rate is the freshwater net fishery in the Stiligwamish River. So that 3.6% is the combination of ceremonial and subsistence fisheries planned by the tribe, as well as incidental catch during pink or coho fisheries in the river. Just sort of, I'll go down the first several on the list. The second highest impact is in the treaty winter troll fishery in areas 3 and 4. It's the treaty troll fishery essentially in the west end of the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Both of those are fisheries where often the actual catches are less than what was modeled pre-season. So that's part of the reason why we consistently come in under post-season. The tribe chooses not to have a ceremonial and subsistence fishery, so they don't use all the planned impacts. And the winter troll fishery often doesn't catch what was modeled pre-season. And continuing down the list, you can see the next two highest impacts on Stiligwamish are the Area 7 sport fishery in the summer and the Area 7 sport fishery in the winter. For those of you that don't know our catch areas, Area 7 is the area around the San Juan Islands and north to the Canadian border. So I won't go down that whole list, but this sort of tells you where, at least from a preseason plan, the impacts on Stiligwamish unmarked Chinook are. The following slide, 37, is the exact same analysis, but looking at marked Stiligwamish Chinook. So since the plan does propose limits on marked Stiligwamish Chinook, this is a look at where the impacts on those are. And you'll see that the top four fisheries with the biggest impact are the same four. The only difference is the Area 7 marked selective fishery in the winter moves up above the winter troll fishery in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. I guess not surprising since this is a marked exploitation rate and that's a marked selective fishery there. So I'll see if people have other questions. I know that's a lot of information and slides there, but if not, I will keep going. So slide 38, as I've said, what the actual management objectives would be on Stiligwamish depend on the abundance forecast in a given year. We don't know what future abundances will look like. We have done some modeling work looking at preseason plan, particularly for 2017, and exploring what changes to fisheries that were planned would be necessary to meet the exploitation rate ceilings at various abundance forecasts. We don't know how fisheries would have been negotiated through North of Falcon if the fisheries we changed would have been the outcome, but we took a shot at it just to give some idea. And the results show us that at lower abundances, there would have needed to be significant changes to treaty and non-treaty fisheries, while at higher abundances, no fishery reductions would have been needed. So moving on to slide 39. These are a lot to absorb, but I'll try to walk through them slowly. So looking at our 2017 preseason abundance forecast and the new management objectives proposed, the original terminal run size predicted was just above 1,100. That abundance would have triggered an 8% unmarked southern U.S. exploitation rate ceiling and a 12.4% marked southern U.S. exploitation rate ceiling. Our original preseason plan for 2017 had an unmarked total exploitation rate on Stillaguamish in all fisheries from Puget Sound to Alaska of 21.7%, an 11.5% unmarked rate in the southern U.S., and a 23.3% marked southern U.S. rate. So we changed some fisheries just to see what it would take to get down to the caps at that abundance. We removed the freshwater sport fishery incidental encounters. We reduced the freshwater net fishery from 35 to 22 Chinook. We reduced the winter treaty troll fishery from 4,500 to 2,000. That change is reflective of what sort of an average catch expectation for that winter troll fishery has been. We then closed the summer sport in Area 7, winter sport in Area 7, 8, and 9, and reduced the Area 9 summer sport quota from 5,500 to 1,000. That would have met the exploitation rate caps at that abundance. Again, I don't want to pretend this is what the outcome would have been through North of Falcon negotiations. We were just trying to take a shot at how big the changes would be needed to meet those ceilings.
Kyle, this is Commissioner Carpenter. Can I go back and re-ask the one question, because maybe I missed your answer. Where did the 8% come from, and when was it developed, and by whom?
So I'll keep going. There's more on the 8% as we move forward, and if you still don't have your answer, we can circle back.
Fair enough.
So slide 40, this was another sort of 2017 preseason look, but we scaled up the abundance forecast for Stillaguamish to above 1,400. At that abundance, the allowable exploitation rate ceilings would have been 12% for unmarked Stillaguamish fish in southern U.S. fisheries and 17.6% for marked Stillaguamish fish. To get to those ceilings, we reduced the Chinook-directed fishery in freshwater from 35 Chinook to 30. We again reduced winter troll from 4,500 to 2,000. And we closed the summer sport Area 7 in July, left August and September open, and closed winter sport in Area 7. Those changes would have gotten to the exploitation rate ceilings at that abundance. And then finally, on slide 41, same exercise, but we scaled the preseason Stillaguamish abundance up to a number higher than 1,500. At that abundance, the allowable exploitation rate ceilings would be 13% for unmarked Stillaguamish fish, southern U.S., and there would be no ceiling on marked fish. At that abundance, it wouldn't have required any changes to fisheries to meet those ceilings. Slide 42, so just restating what I just showed you, that at low abundances, it would take significant reductions to state tribal fisheries to meet the ceilings. At higher abundances, fishery reductions might not be needed to meet the ceilings. Slide 43 gets into, so why an 8% limit in low abundance years? NOAA's RER analysis completed in 2017 shows us that there is productivity in the watershed at low escapements. We know that high stream flows and high sediment levels from landslides have major effects on Chinook survival and productivity. But in those years where we have less severe winter flows, we get much better survival. So if we can maximize escapement in those years where we happen to get good winter conditions, it should lead to increased abundance in subsequent brood years. And in light of the continued Chinook declines, and again, we've jumped around so you haven't seen some of that information, the new plan takes a harder look at conservation when populations are consistently at low abundances. As I said before, the 8% represented a rate slightly above the actual recent year average ER on Stillaguamish Chinook in southern U.S. fisheries. The idea was that we didn't want to increase the southern U.S. fishery impact on this stock above the rates we've actually seen in recent years. Slide 44. The 8% in low abundance years is a very conservative approach, but it considers the importance of the Stillaguamish population for ESA purposes. It reflects the fact that a 10-year ESA plan may call for less risk across the ESU to listed Chinook. So some populations might be at higher risk, some at lower risk, but with trying to get a 10-year plan in place, we're going to have to be a little more conservative. And last, extirpation of this population is not an option for the Stillaguamish tribe and the state of Washington. Slide 45. So are there alternate perspectives on Stillaguamish productivity? As we went through this process, WDFW developed independent spawner recruit analysis that showed some different productivity estimates. The different results in these and recruits expected, that analysis showed some different results in number of recruits we'd expect back at different escapement levels. Those differences led us to ask a lot of questions, but questions like, is there an escapement level above which increased escapement does not result in an increased number of recruits? Is there an escapement level below which producing additional escapement through fishery constraints provides minimal benefit? And if benefits to the population from fishery constraints are minimal, what other tools do we have available to rebuild the population? Slide 46.
Kyle, this is Commissioner Thorburn again. Are those questions answerable, being studied?
Thanks, Commissioner. There are different degrees of answerable, and we're definitely spending a lot of time looking at them, but there's no magic answer today.
Okay, thank you.
So slide 46, if we do accept higher levels of risk for populations, it should be paired with mitigation, and it's an approach we've used in prior plans and in the current plan, where we have harvest rates, exploitation rates that are higher than what NOAA was comfortable with as a starting point. So as we circle back, I'll get through some of the other work NOAA's done. But there are places where we have exploitation rates that are higher than what NOAA says the standard is, but it comes with other mitigation factors. So for the Stillaguamish, development of additional mitigation may be an option. It's an option we've got to explore, and that would include things like hatchery production, our hatchery marking strategy, and habitat improvements to try to increase the productivity of the population. So with that, I'll circle back to the beginning of the presentation and some of the sort of overview things. I'll try to move through them pretty quickly. I'm also going to take a drink of water because I'm about to lose my voice.
So Larry, this is Barbara. Did your question about the origin of the 8% as a threshold get answered?
No, not yet. I think Kyle's getting to that, and I guess I'd like to know to add into that particular question I asked first. Where's NOAA on this 8%? Did they give you that number? Anyway, I'll stand by for an answer.
So, Larry, this is Ron, or Commissioner Carpenter, apologize. This is Ron. Let me be a little bit more direct. I think the information or the question you've asked has been answered in the slide. So obvious negotiations are difficult. And in trying to take or look at multiple options, we looked at what those recent year postseason catches were, and the plan as written identifies that if we can plan for and achieve our preseason plan to come out as a postseason result, that harvest within Puget Sound would not change. So in other words, we know that our recent year averages have been just slightly less than 8%. If we gave ourselves an 8% cap, we're diligent in planning through our preseason exercise of North Falcon to prescribe fisheries that would get us to that and not have cushions within our fisheries. But what we're really going to do, that's how we landed, or that's how that was landed on in the discussion.
Okay, I have two other questions, and if I may. If the RER is 24%, which it is, and the modeled impact was 21%, why would there be a need to further limit southern U.S. fisheries to 8%? First question. Second question, has WFW and the tribes agreed to use the RMP in crafting the 2018 North of Falcon package without exception?
We're being more conservative.
Yeah. Want me to read the first one again, or?
Could you please?
If the RER is 24%, I'm typing as I've been typing and trying to write and keep track of it. If the RER is 24% and the modeled impact was 21%, why would there be a need for to further limit southern U.S. fisheries to 8%?
So, Commissioner Carpenter, this is Kyle. A couple of things there, and some of this will come out as we walk back through the first half of the presentation. NOAA's RER of 24% is for the North Fork Siliguamish population, the healthier of the two. Their RER for the South Fork population is 18%. So NOAA could very well say 24 is not good enough for the aggregate because the weaker component should be at 18.
And Commissioner Carpenter, the second question on have we agreed to use that as a 2018 management objective? No, we have not.
Commissioner McIsaac, question?
Go ahead.
Yeah, just to follow up on the 8% a little bit more. One's kind of another arithmetic question, and the other one is a stock complex question. So, earlier we talked about the preseason business in the past planning for 10 to 15%, and it ended up averaging just under 8%. And that's because of the conservative way that we manage. Is this 8% as it's written now a target or a ceiling? And if it's a ceiling, you'd expect it to come in, I guess, if you use the previous rate as a yardstick of how far below do you think it'll end up in the next 10 years as an average. If you have a ceiling of 8, the number would probably be 6 or 5 or 4. Well, I guess 12.5 going down to 8, so it would probably be around 6. If your management performance, your stock mixes, and everything else are the same, you're not going to get 8% the way you manage, which really means that there's an expectation that this would come in at 6%, not 8%, if you set an 8% ceiling. So that's all kind of a question of mathematics. So let me say, does that mathematics jive, and is this a ceiling or is it a target that you'd recognize you're going to go over and under a little bit, and after 10 years it's supposed to average 8%?
So, Commissioner McIsaac, this is Kyle. I guess the issue with the arithmetic part, and it is a ceiling, the issue with the arithmetic part is that we know we've got have some fisheries that have been preseason projecting numbers that are way above what they really expect to catch. We've got to address that problem. Addressing that problem would mean the difference between the ceiling and the actual outcome should tighten up a lot.
Well, that's a little comforting. If you've got some modeling that has gone on that you know is setting some quotas or some management measures that are never going to be achieved, we obviously ought to reflect reality. I hope that's an annual update type of thing. In the end, if the arithmetic holds, then this is really an expectation for something less than 8%. So if it's a guide, if it's a ceiling and not a target, I guess that would occur. And it's a little bit of a concern. It reminds me of the yellow-eye rockfish situation offshore, where some biological modeling said there ought to be such and such a rate, and we managed conservatively to not exceed that. And then after several years, people come in and say, well, you've been living with that lower rate. Let's make that the ceiling because that's all you've really been getting anyway. And it's a subject to continuous ratcheting down every time you have an exercise like this. And it doesn't end up reflecting back to the original biological targets. Let me ask about the 8% again. Somebody asked, did NOAA ask for this, or were they silent in all of this? I know they're kind of looking from the outside and only supposed to come in when they see something, you know, really so bad that they could never even consider it in the 18-month process. But they're, my understanding is that they're not sitting right at the table offering their own policy opinions about what might be reasonable. So did NOAA indeed say any policy perspective about this 8%, or did they recommend it?
So, Commissioner McIsaac, this is Ron. No, they did not. They were not at the table. They did not participate in the negotiations with the Stillaguamish tribe.
Was there discussion about this being a target instead of a ceiling? And you don't have to answer that now. I mean, this is all gets into the U.S. v. Washington thing. If that's a better question to be answered on January 19th, that's fine.
I would prefer to wait until the executive session to answer that, Commissioner. Thank you.
Yeah, that's fine. My other stock complex question is that we're focusing on the 24%. The 12%, the 8%, and all of those things for Stillaguamish Chinook, as opposed to summer Chinook that spawn in the North Fork. Is there a separate set of ceilings and limits and everything else for South Fork that we haven't heard about yet? Or is this an aggregate that would, if this plan was adopted later tonight, that would be the limit for the aggregate?
So, Commissioner McIsaac, this is Kyle again. It is an aggregate. The abundances that trigger the various rates are aggregates, and the exploitation rates are on the aggregate. And those aggregates are not just North Fork and South Fork natural origin fish. The abundance thresholds actually include hatchery origin fish as well.
Kyle, this is Larry. Just a quick one. Are we using that same averaging scenario on other systems with multiple forks?
We are. Thanks, Commissioner Carpenter. For example, the Skagit, we manage the summer-fall populations, the three of those, and the three spring populations. One rate for summer falls, one rate for springs.
Larry, this is Brad.
Yeah, Brad.
Do we do that on the Nooksack as well?
You know, I don't know.
To Kyle, do you know Kyle?
Yes, Commissioner Smith, we do that on the Nooksack as well.
Okay, thanks.
I have a question here. If the preseason package modeled result was 18%, and the SUS was modeled at 9%. Why would the SUS need to be reduced from 9% to 8%? And confirmed that the tribes in WFW have not agreed to use the RMP increase. I think, Ron, you said they haven't. I just wanted to, I was thinking about something else, and I maybe didn't get your answer. So they have that. There's not agreement between the state and the tribes on the RMP in crafting the 2018 North of Falcon, right?
Yeah, so let me clarify, Commissioner Carpenter. Thanks for that. Originally, the idea was that the 8%, if the abundance came in at the low abundance threshold, would be utilized. Because the plan is currently has been deemed insufficient from NOAA and work continues, we have not established all of the stocks. We haven't looked at the landscape of Puget Sound for risks and benefits of where we are over or under the recovery exploitation rates, as we've talked about this afternoon. So I would say that it is not set for 2018 until that plan is complete.
Okay. Well, the first part of my question was the preseason package modeling result was 18%, and the SUS was modeled at 9. Why would we drop from 9 to 8? I mean, it seems like we're inflicting pain where maybe it's not totally needed. Can you give me an answer to that one, your thoughts on it?
So, this Ron again, Commissioner Carpenter. The thoughts there were that it was a conservative approach, and that where we had the ability to have additional fish on spawning grounds could be a benefit because of the small levels of productivity that NOAA saw in their analysis. And therefore, we believe that taking that step could prove beneficial as a recovery action for the stocks.
Okay.
Commissioner McIsaac, question.
Go ahead,
on marked Stillaguamish hatchery fish. You mentioned something about alternative ways of marking fish or something like that. I think we got a letter in public testimony about that. But, of course, there's a lot of hatchery fish being released under the presumption that there would be a marked selective fishery for them. And that was known as these fish were being marked with an adipose clip to start with. But because the hatchery survival is so much higher, carrying that fishery impact seemed reasonable. I wasn't quite clear on how that changes in this, except that there had never been any sort of a limit before on marked selective fisheries. So could you elaborate a little bit more about what you see the impact of that, and what did you mean by there's other ways of dealing with this, or whatever you said?
So, Commissioner McIsaac, this is Kyle again. The other ways of dealing with that, you might be referring to the idea that we can look at how we're marking these hatchery fish. They're currently marked and tagged so that they can be used as an indicator stock, so we can track where harvest occurs. The size of the release group, how many fish need to be marked as part of that, is something we can look at. If we find ways to increase hatchery production, we can look at not marking the additional production. That's the sort of solution I was talking about there.
So you've got several years under your belt now where they've been marked and tagged, and that was a very good idea back when it was controversial, because now you do know how heavily these are exploited in the northern fisheries and where in Puget Sound they go. But I wonder if you don't have to do that every year, year in and year out, to get kind of the same information, and you can extrapolate from the past. Was there any exploration of not marking these fish and releasing these conservation hatchery type fish as unmarked fish so they would not be caught in marked selective fisheries, but would also not impair the conduct of marked selective fisheries? Was that discussed and rejected? And if you don't want to answer that, you can hold that one for later, too.
Commissioner McIsaac, this is Ron. Thanks for the question. I think that briefly we talked about the mitigation packages that could be developed in the maybe the final package. I'm unaware of that occurring, but early on in negotiations, I think it's a willingness of co-managers to talk about the benefits of production and marking strategies, as well as needed habitat restoration programs or projects within the Stille Guamish. That would be no surprise to anybody. So both parties are very interested in continuing those conversations, or whether they lead to different solutions here in the plan, or just additional work and commitments to work together later. I believe that we have equal thought about what we'd like to try to explore to make strides to benefit the resources.
Ron, this is Larry Carpenter again. We, if we're going into North of Falcon in 45 days or so, and the expectation is the Stille is going to come in low abundance, I would expect that the state and the tribes are going to utilize the 8% number for 2018 planning. The other question I think I want to ask Mr. Grossman is, and you don't have to elaborate on this, but maybe you can give me some thoughts on it. With NOAA's role in this 8% issue, and we can't, we have to talk in the U.S. v. Washington forum. I mean, we're going to do that in executive session, and can you give me the rationale for that?
So, Commissioner Carpenter, this is Ron first. The management objective piece, you're right. North of Falcon is quickly approaching, and co-managers will have to have agreed to management objectives to provide to NOAA by, say, the 20th or so of February, so the guidance letter to the council can be written, and we can proceed without those obstacles in our way. That's the only plausible way to have a smooth year, and we will be working hard to get there post the outcomes of these meetings.
Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chairman, another question for me.
Yeah, Don.
So this harvest rate schedule here of 12%, well, 24% total, 12% for the southern U.S., if things are really bad, 8%, but they've been really bad the last couple of years, and people are speculating already that it might be that way again. Forecasts aren't out yet. So there's an off-ramp when things get worse than expected. The 24% is proposed as an ESA limit, and if it was approved, that would pass muster. The Federal Endangered Species Act is protecting these fish sufficiently. And if fish get in worse shape, the 24% stands, but in the southern U.S., we ratchet things back by more than 4%. So again, this is some sort of a measure that if things get worse, here's a response. It's not that appealing to me that the northern fisheries get held harmless on that, but my question has to do with an off-ramp in the other direction. So if things get better, and I'll lay out two different scenarios where they could get better. One is, 10 years is a long time. 10 years ago down here on the Columbia River, we never expected that the 2013 and 14 and 15 upriver bright runs would explode up to, nearly a million fish or over. I think one year back to the Columbia, the strongest run since 1925. That was totally unexpected. And we're so glad that it happened, but it was unexpected. And the ocean conditions can get very, very favorable, and you can't forecast that accurately for 10 years. The other thing that could happen would be that the Alaska and Canadian stocks fall flat and collapse. And we saw this off the coast of the southern U.S. when the Sacramento River False Chinook collapsed unexpectedly. Here one year came along, and there's basically no jacks. And so everywhere in the ocean that Sacramento fish were found, it was closed to sport and commercial fisheries. It was unexpected. It was unprecedented. It had never happened before. But as a result, the fish coming back to the Klamath River and the Rogue River and the Umpqua River and places that have the same ocean migration route as Sacramento fish got a, quote, a windfall profit in terms of their abundance, and had very high abundance there. So if for some reason the Canadian stocks or the Alaskan stocks, the few that are in the fishery, collapsed, and the Pacific Salmon Commission elected to have, hypothetically, you know, an extreme closure, and the 24% is sitting there as having passed ESA muster as protecting the species from extinction, and to the south, we're still at 8%. Someone could say, well, you could go to 10% or 15% or 18% or anything else like that and still be under the limit that was set. And as a policy choice at that time, you could decide whether or not it was warranted. Maybe there's lots of coho in the Puget Sound or other hatchery stocks. You know, we've heard about enhancement for killer whales. Lots of unknowns here. So my question is, there's no off-ramp that I can see in the upside if we get some surprisingly beneficial, so to speak, unexpected things that that could open things up on the top end. And the decision, of course, could be made at that year whether you want to use them or not. But is it true that there is no off-ramp in the upward direction here?
Thanks, Commissioner McIsaac. This is Kyle again. I don't think there's a prescribed off-ramp other than the commitment in one of the last sections of the plan to reassess productivity as new data becomes available, and if the picture is different, then to adjust and resubmit to NOAA accordingly.
Yeah, in terms of the length of time in that process, it's not that conducive to finding something out from the Pacific Salmon Commission in February or March and going into the North of Falcon business within a few days of that. It would seem on this particular approval is on a 18-24-month schedule. That wasn't a question. We can just maybe hold that thought, and we have only gone through part of this presentation, so maybe there's a lot more in it.
Well, this is Commissioner Thorburn. I have a question about what Commissioner McIsaac is bringing up, and it's kind of a procedural question. Would that be something that is delegated for the negotiations with our co-managers, or is that a policy question? And if so, is that something that would go into the North of Falcon policy? That's my question.
Commissioner Thorburn, this is Ron. I'll give that my shot. Through the delegation order, I think that the director and staff have been delegated the responsibility to negotiate. To further elaborate on Commissioner McIsaac's comments, I don't see an absolute off-road on the other direction, Commissioner. I do see an abundance-based approach that has a sliding scale upward as abundance increases from 8 to 13%. But I don't see the off-road that you're looking at. Do I believe that those types of issues, situations, planning efforts are delegated? Yes, I do. And it would be up to us to negotiate that and recall or report back to the commission about those.
Thank you.
Uh, This may be another procedural question. I know that people were very, very busy on this plan through the fall of 2017, and there's so much to consider. Was there significant discussion, and then maybe this is another question you can reserve for answering later. Was there significant discussion about the concept of an off-ramp in the up direction, or if there's a surprise in the Pacific Salmon Commission take, and the options were looked at, and it was thoroughly discussed, and that was relegated to the escape clause language that Mr. Addix referred to?
Commissioner McIsaac, this is Ron. I'm unaware of any of those conversations occurring during the negotiations.
Thank you.
Commissioner Carpenter, just to check in for you and I, we've got about 55 minutes left. I think that this has been a great conversation and don't want to stifle it, although I know we have a significant number of slides that remain to give some base for ESA and what we do when we get into these situations and management of the Chinook stocks in Puget Sound. I'm wondering if we can continue and then pick up questions and answers as we complete the slides.
Yeah, you want to move off the Stille discussion, Ron? Is that what you want to do? I mean, move into more generic content?
I was hoping to give some background of the Endangered Species Act as well as the plan and part of the mediation background so commissioners and the public knew about those two key elements that drove us or give us guidance. And then if we have time, maybe we can circle back and continue the conversation about the Stille Duwamish.
Well, okay. Vice Chairman, one last question before we leave that.
Go ahead.
So there's been some claims, and it's a difficult read, this 345 pages, I'll just have to say that. A lot of talk about the Stille Duwamish being the key critical stock that is the focus of all of this. And so of the other stocks, when you get around to them, is it really true that the Stille Duwamish is the one here that we saw the graphs on the fall population and the North Fork population and the South Fork population, the falls and the summers, and that was judged as a significant enough problem to do these significant measures. Are there other stocks in this Puget Sound area that have that kind of decline or worse? And it's not really true that Stille Duwamish are the most declining stock, and that when we get the full presentation, we're going to hear about some other places that have even worse declines, and they're actually more constraining.
Commissioner McIsaac, this is Ron. I may ask Kyle to add some depth to my answer. What I would offer first is that when we look at the Nooksack populations, we know that our exploitation rate ceilings in recent years have been around 10%, and that the NOAA RER is at 4 currently. We also know that our exploitation rate ceilings for that stock are over, and therefore mitigation is required. So the hatchery programs, conservation programs that are conducted by the tribe and the state, or tribes in the state, are mitigation for that over-exploitation from northern fisheries and state fisheries. So, when I say state in that particular instance, I mean state and tribal for Washington. So that's one that I would point to immediately.
Thank you.
So this is Kyle. I might just add, at the combination of rates proposed in the plan, if Stillaguamish remains at low abundance, it's likely to be the most restrictive. When we get back into the presentation, you'll see what some of the feedback NOAA's been given us, which means we don't know that we might wind up having to be more conservative other places, which could lead to other stocks being the most constraining, the most restrictive. So maybe I'll go back to page 3 to some of the background, and I'll try to move pretty quickly through the general stuff. Page 3 is just some background on the ESA listing. Puget Sound Chinook were listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act back in March of 1999. The following year, July of 2000, NMFS ordered the National Marine Fisheries Service ordered their Salmon 4D rule, establishing the take prohibitions for Puget Sound Chinook. Page 4, I'll just really quickly say there were limits on the application of take prohibitions on plans and activities that met the 4D rules criteria. The one to focus in on here that we'll be talking about is the joint tribal state plans developed under USV Washington or USV Oregon processes. Won't go into any of the other detail on that slide. So moving to slide 5, again, it's limit 6 is the limit in the 4D rule that applies to joint state tribal resource management plans. And since the listing, the Puget Sound Treaty Tribes and WDFW have submitted a series of jointly developed fishery management plans under that limit 6, including long-term plans that were submitted in 2004 and 2010. Moving on to slide 6 and going back to the last long-term plan the co-manager submitted, we submitted a plan in 2010 that was submitted as a 5-year plan intended to cover fisheries through 2014. As NOAA started their analysis on that plan, they started to have concerns relative to southern resident killer whales and asked the co-managers, essentially told the co-managers they didn't think they could approve a 5-year plan, asked us to modify the duration, so we modified the duration of the plan to be a 4-year plan covering fisheries through 2013. In 2014, the Bureau of Indian Affairs requested a Section 7 consultation to cover 2014 state and tribal fisheries, and the BIA funding of tribal fishery management activities was used as a nexus for that consultation. The plan that year was essentially an extension of the 2010 plan. There were some modifications to some of the objectives, but it was essentially identical to the 2010 plan. In 2015, a similar extension occurred that covered 2015 fisheries. The following year, 2016, we were planning to use that same BIA Section 7 nexus for ESA coverage, but the co-managers did not reach agreement on fisheries during the normal North of Falcon process, so we didn't have coverage for Puget Sound fisheries for a period of almost 2 months. There were tribal fisheries that were authorized and moved forward during that time, but WDFW could not find a nexus for Section 7 ESA consultation until we reached agreement with the tribes on fisheries for that year. Then in October of 2016, the United States and 16 tribes requested a meet and confer under the provisions of USV Washington regarding a request for determination to develop a court-approved regional salmon management plan. The state and tribes agreed to mediation in lieu of litigation. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Grossman for a few slides. He's helped us through this mediation process and understanding it all, so he's going to speak for a few minutes.
If I may, Kyle, I just want to say to you and the staff involved, requesting changing the scheduling of this agenda and having the Stilly up front, I really appreciate the extra effort and the short notice that you put forward to get this done. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner.
May I ask a quick question before we move on, Larry?
Sure.
So why, since the previous agreed upon plans have been 5 years and actually had to be shortened on the last one because of other ESA concerns, why are we going with a 10-year plan? Why so ambitious?
Thanks, Commissioner Thurman. A big factor is the workload just to complete a plan. I mean, we completed what was supposed to be a five-year plan, and by the time we're done with that, we're having to work on the next plan. So a lot of it really has to do with just having the bandwidth to get a plan done, all the coordination it takes with the tribes, and not wanting to have to turn around and do it again in a year.
And then that was, I assume, the feeling of the co-managers as well?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Commissioners, this is Mike Grossman with the Attorney General's Office. As many of you know, since we've been working at this for a while, you know, this arose, the current resource management plan for Chinook was negotiated as part of a mediation process. We've been talking with you about that for a while. These slides, I think, therefore, serve two functions. There's kind of a reminder and refresher of where we've been. But I know this issue has also been a big topic of concern for people in the public who view this as kind of a secret behind-the-scenes kind of thing. And I think it's important for them to understand how this came about and, you know, what some of our choices were and what some of the things are that we really didn't have a lot of choice on. So as Kyle mentioned, the thing that prompted this mediation was that near-nuclear meltdown of the 2016 North of Falcon fisheries, the failure to develop mutually agreed fisheries, and the ultimate resulting chaos in the ESA coverage. The Department of Justice attorneys contacted me, and so did some of the tribal attorneys, saying, gee, we'd like to try and work on something better for the future. And in October of 2016, they sent a meet-and-confer request to the Department of Fish and Wildlife under the continuing jurisdiction in U.S. v. Washington. And on slide 9, I define a little bit better what a meet and confer is. Part of the court's order on continuing jurisdiction requires a meet and confer notice to be sent by any party that's ultimately thinking about the possibility of going to the court and having the court order something. And in this particular case, DOJ and the tribes were contemplating the possibility of getting adjustments to things like the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan, the Hood Canal Plan, the stipulation on co-management, and some of the other orders that exist out there about how we plan for fisheries. Part of the reason for that, quite frankly, is that some of the stuff that was written, you know, decades ago sometimes have changed dramatically since we've moved from an escapement-based management with a pretty easy sense of what harvestable surplus is to the much more complex environment that we live in now with mixed stock fisheries, where you might have an abundant stock of fish, particularly, you know, a marked selective hatchery fish, but intermixed with ESA-limited fish, and where now the, you know, the currency of allocation sometimes seems to be ESA limitations and how you share those rather than the old method of doing things. So we live in a substantially more difficult and complex environment. That's been one of the challenges that we faced. So they wanted to talk about that, and that, you know, a lot of that requires adjusting court orders. So they came at this from a, hey, we may have to litigate this, but let's do what the court told us to do. Let's have a meet and confer. So we had that meeting, and, you know, that the kind of changes that we'd have to make are significant enough that you can't just do it in a meeting. And so they did the next thing, which the court's order calls for, which is to see if you can set up a long-term negotiating process. And that was to request mediation. And, you know, I think typically mediation is done in the context of potential litigation. It's a choice. I think it's important to recognize here that the court's order on continuing jurisdiction actually speaks in a lot stronger terms than a simple choice on this. In my slide, I've referred to it as providing strong encouragement, but I do want to actually read from you briefly on the court's order on continuing jurisdiction. It says, where you don't solve your problem in your meet and confer meeting, which you typically don't, the requesting party, that would be DOJ and the tribes here, and all affected parties, that would include DFW, shall participate in mediation, which shall be conducted pursuant to the federal court's local rules. So, you know, I think from the tribe's perspective, and I think from DOJ's perspective, mediation was a necessary outcome once they teed this up as a potential litigation matter because we're seeking to adjust court orders. And the only reason I'm going to be a little bit hesitant about it is I do think that there's some room to shape how mediation occurs. I do think there is a way to professional level, but there's also some challenges, and we're going to be talking with you about that, I think, in executive session on the 19th. In any event, they asked for mediation so we could do this, and we got an order from Judge Martinez, who's the current judge sitting on the U.S. v. Washington case, referring the matter to a mediation judge. That was granted and assigned to Judge Peckman. Now, mediation has some clear benefits. It encourages candid sharing of information. That's really critical when you've got really difficult issues that you're working with. It's a structured process that can ensure really timely resolution of disputes. The Chinook management plan was the first priority of business because the perception was the most important thing was to avoid what we saw in 2016, where some people were fishing and other people were, based on, you know, scattered ESA coverage. So I think everybody's first priority has always been to reconfigure the negotiating landscape so we all have an ESA coverage from which to work from. That's why that was the most important thing, and we were trying to get it done for the 2019 fisheries because NOAA's always said it takes about 18 months, best case, from the time you have a sufficient RMP. So, you know, I think mediation was viewed as a very good way of getting timely resolution of things and keeping us on a schedule. I will say, having done a similar thing with the USV Oregon 10-year management plan that we recently renegotiated, and Judge Levy, a senior judge on the Ninth Circuit, was the mediating judge there, he was extremely effective in keeping the parties on time and moving forward, and I would say Judge Peckman here was also a very effective mediating judge in terms of keeping the parties in line here. I think we'd be way farther behind in terms of the development of a Chinook management plan had we not had court involvement with a mediated process. And you know, it also allows parties to manage litigation risk over issues. Clearly, there's some litigation risk here if we have to go into court and fight over what plans look like. But I think realistically, we also need to remember that there are other people who are looking at this and sometimes litigate. One of the most recent long-term plans, you know, not a 10-year plan, but a 4-year plan, was litigated in the past. Salmon Spawning Recovery Alliance lawsuit with challenged a long-term plan. And I think one of the motivations here to pursue mediation was to try and manage that litigation risk, to have candid conversations in a mediation context and allow people to sort of noodle ideas without then having those become fodder for future litigation. So one of the features, as I say, that assists in achieving mediation objectives is this concept of confidentiality here. And I will say that it's important to remember that once you are in mediation, and I don't think it would have been a good idea, and it would have been very difficult to refuse it here in light of the order on continuing jurisdiction, is that mediation is a presumption. The parties have to agree unanimously to dispense with mediation here, and this is something that we thought about very carefully because we recognize that engaging in discussions in a confidential mediation process is at odds with complete transparency at a government level. That's just one of the tensions that exists. There's no getting around it. So the idea is, how can you best manage that tension? There was no chance that we would get all the parties to agree to non-confidential mediations. It was the default thing that came with mediation. We were able to relax the mediation confidentiality in one respect, and that's with regard to NOAA's involvement. And that was, I think, a really important step because, well, for two reasons. First of all, I think it helps with transparency, so it helps mitigate this concept of being able to surface important issues and have them vetted by the public and looked at. And secondly, NOAA's ESA evaluations under the federal APA absolutely have to be done in open, so that was a real important piece of relaxing of the confidentiality. But there was no way to get complete consensus on completely eliminating confidentiality, so it was just going to be part of the mix of things going into mediation.
Okay, ask a question.
Go ahead.
This is Barbara. So when we're defining, is confidentiality limited to the parties in the lawsuit? And then within that, who's deciding who, to a person or to a group, who's a party and who's not?
So the part, yeah, that's a good question. So the parties to the mediation are the requesting tribes and the state of Washington. Now, NOAA is, I would say, not exactly a party to the mediation for two reasons. First of all, they were there. I mean, Peter Dygert and Susan Bishop were there. NOAA's general counsel was there. A certain limited number of conversations that weren't directly related to development of the RMP, the resource management plan that NOAA had to evaluate, were within the ambit of that. But because we recognized that NOAA would eventually have to take a product from us and evaluate it, and any conversations that we had with NOAA directly would have to be part of their administrative decision-making record, that part, while you could argue perhaps the federal government, including NOAA, was a party to the mediation, that part was expressly recognized as something that needs to be, you know, completely available for everybody to take a look at. So, you know, circling back to your question, I think, therefore, the confidentiality order really most clearly prevents us from revealing positions that the tribe brought to us in mediation. It does not preclude the commission. I mean, the state of Washington is a party to the mediation, and that means the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife is comprised of a commission, the director, and the director's staff. All those entities on the state side have and had access to all of the mediation materials. There's a separate issue about how the commission can be involved in mediation given the Open Public Meetings Act, and as one of the slides here indicates at the bottom of page 12, typically that presents some real challenges, but the way you effectively navigate that is with delegated decision making, and as I think Kyle previously mentioned, or Ron previously mentioned, the way we did this is very consistent with the commission's delegation to the director and the director's staff to engage in those negotiations. So,
I have a quick question, if I may. What is the penalty if one of the parties breaches confidentiality, or is there?
So there is not a prescribed penalty, but clearly breaching confidentiality produces a violation of a federal court order. I think it's safe to say that's not something you want to do. I did a fair bit of research on this issue as we were going in to make sure we understood the complete landscape. Typically, parties, if there's a breach of confidentiality, will bring a motion and seek various sanctions depending on the effect of the breach of confidentiality. Rather than sort of think about what the consequences might be, I think the better course of action is just to say, let's understand what confidentiality means and make sure we don't breach it.
Yeah.
So in terms of state law, the State's Public Record Act is consistent with this concept of the utility there being some utility in confidentiality during mediations. And so the Public Records Act recognizes that while generally speaking we have a transparency desire, there are circumstances where mediation makes sense. And consistent with the desire for confidentiality to be a productive use of mediation, our Public Records Act exempts from disclosure those things obtained from another party during mediation. So as I said, the other challenge is how to loop the commission and the public in, because I think we did enter into this feeling like it would be important to do that. It's very difficult to engage in mediation with confidentiality where the negotiating body is also subject to the Open Public Meetings Act. Therefore, the typical way of navigating that is through a delegation order. You already had a delegation order, and this slotted in very nicely to make that work. There is authority for delegated decision-making on agreements. Under RCW 7704-055-4, this is on slide 13, the commission has final approval authority for tribal, interstate, international, and any other department agreements relating to fish and wildlife. At the same token, under RCW 7704-020, the commission may delegate to the director any of the powers and duties vested in the commission. And that is what happens here. There is a commission delegation order dated August 5th, 2017, that addresses development of co-manager plans and agreements, and that's outlined at the bottom of slide 13. The director and his staff have the authority to enter into co-management and has the authority to negotiate and reach conclusion on things like management plans and other agreements. I think the resource management plan is one of those. There is similar, I think, delegation authority under the North of Falcon delegation order as well.
Mike, this is Larry Carpenter. Is there no language in there about reasonable consultation annually or otherwise on issues like this?
Well, the last sentence of that delegation provides, the director shall annually report to the commission on issues associated with co-management agreements. So your current delegation order requires a once-a-year check-in. I don't think that precludes more frequent ones, but what you've communicated in your delegation order right now is an annual check-in. So, very briefly, we've covered some of this on slide number 14. The mediation order that comes with it has a reference to the local court's order on confidentiality. The mediation confidentiality bars sharing mediation communications, either written or oral, that were obtained by DFW during mediation. But the commission is not barred from obtaining information relating to the mediations, including negotiations on the Chinook plan. It's just that any commission action in that regard has to be undertaken in open public meeting. So this requires very careful thought about how you go about reviewing the substance of these mediation communications, how you may or may not participate in any mediation suggestions, sessions. Again, I think that the best way is through the delegated decision-making authority in order to avoid, you know, court orders on mediation confidentiality. And I want to clarify again that, you know, the commission was briefed periodically through the director's reports on the general status of the mediation and Chinook RMP development. The problem is when you get into substantive briefings, that's where we would need to have some very careful crosswalk between what we can reveal on things we've obtained from other parties as opposed to things that you want to weigh and discuss. And I think we'll be talking with you about that in executive session on the 19th. So my last slide is number 15 here, and I'm basically kind of now looking into the future. Where do we go from here? The Chinook RMP is not yet sufficient from NOAA's perspective, so even though it was delivered to NOAA on December 1st, it's not quite clear we've got a fair bit of work to do. Not just a little, but a fair bit. I think several months' worth of work was what NOAA estimated, and it wouldn't surprise me if we're talking about more than 2 months, maybe 3 or 4 months. That means the co-managers are going to need to work together to make adjustments, and there will also be continuing dialogue with NOAA. The tribes have expressed a desire to continue the mediation process for negotiating further revisions, but any communications with NOAA would continue to be undertaken outside of mediation confidentiality. So the director and staff are presently operating under your existing current delegation order, and you know we will have some conversations with you about what options that presents going forward. At the last meeting that we had with NOAA and the tribes on the 5th of January, I think we made it clear to them that we want more process built into the negotiating process to come back to the commission and to interact with the public. That there is a way, in my feeling, is there's a way to have a crosswalk between mediation confidentiality, where communications to us remain confidential, but also to be able to surface significant details and have the commission get substantive briefings and provide input to the department as we move forward. That's going to be the tricky thing, but I think it's a path that, with some good work, we can navigate and accommodate.
May I ask a question?
Please.
So the delegation preceded my time on the commission. I'm assuming, in hearing your presentation about the delegation, and that it's an important potential process for handling this need for confidentiality during mediation, and mediation being something that we've legally been ordered to under the court, that was a consideration when we provided delegation. That's one part. The second part of my question is, if we do get more briefings and that crosswalk that you're talking about, how do we ensure that it continues as delegation, and when are we kind of getting involved in taking that delegation away?
So two questions. Let me see if I can deal with the second one first. I mean, I think this is part of a continuing discussion that you're going to have as a commission and with the director and his staff about what the best path forward is. And I think some of this we're going to have to do in executive session because I feel like some of that really touches on a mediation that can carry some litigation risk. What I can say is that me and my colleagues over the AG have been working with various people in the Attorney General's office who are constantly looking at the Open Public Meetings Act and the Public Records Act to ensure that the values of transparency in those statutory provisions are respected, and not just respected, but in spirit also really pushed. This clearly is a scenario in which there's a certain tension that exists because, and is recognized by state law, because, you know, mediation, while normally a voluntary thing, here is less voluntary, and entering into mediation comes with confidentiality, which clearly is in tension with full transparency. So, the path forward isn't easy because of that tension. It's clearly difficult. And what I feel comfortable saying now is that I think there's a way to navigate it. I think where you start running into problems is two places, where you would want to reveal communications that you receive from a party to the mediation, where that party doesn't necessarily want those communications revealed, but obviously they're part of your decision-making process. So, and then the second piece is, you know, how much of this can you do in an open public meeting format, which is what this governing body needs to do to be compliant with the OPMA. And the way to traverse that, in my view, is to continue with the delegation of decision-making process. And maybe the crosswalk there is that you have more frequent check-ins, and we talk about the manner in which there can be open public meeting discussions without crossing that boundary of confidentiality. It's not going to be super easy, and it's not going to be super comfortable, but I think there's a way to do that. It will take some additional negotiating time, because one of the problems that you have with a mediation is that the mediator always says, come to me with your decision makers. I'm not doing a mediation where I don't have decision makers. That's one of the first things you hear from a mediator. So I think the way you do this is you turn the negotiation into some chunks, and you have some delegated decision making, and you have some frequent check-ins with the right sideboards to mean that the conversations that occur are substantive without revealing communications that you by order can't reveal. Now, you know, it's not going to be perfect, but I think you can still accomplish as much as you can of both the objectives that exist with confidential mediation while at the same time being as transparent as you can. Again, I don't think it'll be easy, but I think there's a path forward.
Thank you. Oh, Larry, this is Barbara. Okay for me to ask a question? As I look at this, there's an important distinction to be made between what happened in terms of the substance of this plan and confidentiality and who's included. And I look at the substance on one side and whether the commission should have been or whether the public should have been on another. And that's not just with respect to this plan, but it's also the only good thing about this, as far as I'm concerned, is that we are carefully considering these things now. And so, because they will impact us in other issues in the future. So we're going to figure this out, and we'll figure it out. On the substance, my question is, we have heard now that NOAA has deemed the plan non-sufficient. I've also heard from a bunch of people writing letters and that sort of thing that that the plan will be reopened. When NOAA says that it's non-sufficient, do they write back and say, we don't like this particular part of this sentence and you've got to work on that? And so how specific are they, and how reopened is this plan going to be?
So
Commissioner Baker, Ron. So what we're receiving back from NOAA are comments about particular paragraphs within the main body of the chapters. That was their initial piece. They've given it to us in chunks, if you will. And now we're receiving the management unit profiles, and their specific questions about particular items. I think we've received six back or so with comments, and it varies in the specificity about what their comments are, and we're starting to set up meetings back to the manager to say, okay, what's this mean? Can we start to develop timelines on what the how to complete the work that they are requiring to get at that? And just so people know, public that are on the phone, we're working hard to try to get those put in a format and get them on our webpage so everybody has access to everything that we've received back from NOAA, so that they can see the comments on each of the watersheds and in each of those chapters of the plan that's coming back from NOAA.
So it's our position that our negotiations with NOAA don't fall into this confidentiality morass?
No.
Okay.
It's part of, matter of fact, NOAA can't have it that way because they have to develop a record for their decision. So what they're doing is their back and forth becomes part of the ongoing work as well as the development of their record for their final decision that they'll put on the Federal Register.
And last
Chair Carpenter.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Since we've entered into mediation on this, is there any way we can back out, or is a die cast? Because I'm just going to say, sitting here listening to this, I'm getting literally sick to my stomach of the thought that we're entering into such an agreement and we truly can't be open and honest and candid to the people of this state that we're serving, that, yeah, we just got to take a leap of faith and hope this all works out. So I guess my question is, once we're in mediation, are we 100% committed, or is there a out for this?
So this is Mike Grossman. Let me try to take a shot at that. So a couple things. Hopefully part of what I was communicating to you earlier is, I think, an understanding that given the significance of the RMP, it is incredibly important for our form of government to have some dialogue at the commission level and with the public. And, you know, I think part of the reason that the PURE that exists now, let's be candid about that, is because we were moving pretty darn fast at the end to try and get something submitted to NOAA because there was such a high priority on the December 1st timeline for May 2019 fishery coverage. Well, that's just not going to happen now. We have some more time. So, you know, moving forward, the question then becomes, can we have a system that accommodates both the mediation side of things, where parties have confidential conversations to develop things, but also the desire to have commission and public involvement? And I do think there is a way for that to happen. Setting that aside for a sec, to the extent that maybe somebody is skeptical about that, I want to engage your question, which is, could we pull out of the mediation? So I'll go back to the order on continuing jurisdiction, which says, you know, the contesting parties shall participate in mediation. There are other parts of that order, I don't want to get into too much detail, that talk about moving the court for relief. I think that would be a difficult go unless we had a very good reason, and I would like to instead explore with you, perhaps partly in executive session, what your options are to ensure that we are formulating a position about mediation that's consistent with the continual order on continuing jurisdiction that requires mediation and the limited window I think that exists for pulling out of that. And I think before we would get still doable, which is to accommodate both the mediation confidentiality component, but also components of public transparency and commission involvement. Is that helpful?
Jay, do you have any more comments for Mr. Grossman?
No, I'm just going to shut this one out and listen. Thank you.
You know, go ahead, Mr. Keeney.
I appreciate the well laid out description of how everything kind of went down. I think the public in general doesn't always understand that. I think even commissioners sometimes have to be reminded of these things. But, you know, of course there was always other things. If we didn't go to mediation, we'd end up in litigation. And what are the results of that probably being considered? So there's what I appreciate hearing today was a review of the well-thought-out process that went on to get us where we're at now. I'm not saying we did a good job in putting out the word to the public of what was going on and why we were in that process where we were. And I think that's one thing we have to be very, we have to improve on, is that as I listen to this today and understand it now, there weren't a ton of other options, but the people that, you know, we've been hearing from in countless emails at this point don't understand that and didn't understand that, and we didn't do a good job of having. So I'll just say that.
Commissioner McIsaac with a question.
Go ahead, Doug.
And maybe this is just a heads up of a question for the executive session on the 19th. But pointed out that NOAA has asked that the plan be reopened, so to speak, to take a look at a couple of their concerns. We did meet the December 1st deadline to get something out, and now they're asking for that to be reopened for a perspective of theirs. That cost the original timeline, but in the search for quality over time, maybe that's the kind of thing. The commission being the policy body on this, holds the final policy decision making, and in terms of delegating that to the director and the staff, if everything was as smooth as we all hoped, then the original policy delegation and any basis about that and the lack of any corrective courses during any check-ins with the commission would make this a pretty smooth sale. But we've had a little bit of a difficult sale, and so maybe on the 19th, if we could ask a few more questions about whether the appropriateness of the commission and their policy decision-making responsibility, suggesting that there be some of the kind of adjustments, the magnitude of adjustments that NOAA is already asking about for some other watersheds. And given the timeline, that fits into what is now perceived by those that are engaged in the mediation as a delayed time frame. You don't have to answer that right now, but I think that will be a focal question on the 19th. And you can answer it now if you'd like.
Commissioner McIsaac, this is Ron. I think the 19th is in exec session is the appropriate place to have that conversation and provide that answer.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions by anyone?
So, Commissioner Carpenter, just a matter of check-in. I have received a note from Tammy that says we can go beyond the 4 o'clock hour if we are still proceeding. Again, I don't want to stifle the conversation. I have found this extremely helpful. I certainly hope the commissioners have. What are your wishes about continuing with questions and answers versus the trying to finalize making it through the presentation?
I think we can try and meet the 4 o'clock hour unless someone has, I mean, we could go on probably till midnight, but I don't know that that's fruitful. So unless anyone has any other ideas, I think we should kind of wrap it up for now, because I know we're going to continue on in great detail next a week from now.
I concur, Larry, yeah.
So for clarification, Commissioner Carpenter, are you saying maybe I can ask the question of were there issues that the commission would like us to dig into a little bit more, provide additional information on? We certainly had questions about the Stillaguamish. We've certainly got a couple of questions that we know we are going to talk about in executive session, but to wrap it up there and come and present to you next Friday and then go into executive session for further conversation.
Yeah, I think that'd be fine, Ron. I do have one question I missed on my list here that I wanted to ask earlier. About where we are in U.S. Canada, and as far as what may come out of that that might provide us some relief, is there any potential for that, or are we just going to be hamstrung without any upside, like Commissioner McIsaac asked about?
And so, Commissioner Carpenter, they are negotiating this weekend, over this weekend. I know that the high-level state commissioner Anderson and the shadow from the department, Jim Scott, are planning a presentation in February, followed by executive session to provide in-depth discussions about the international agreement being negotiated.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
As we wrap up, and particularly for the public who are still listening, could you guys give us a short synopsis of really where we are now in all of this?
So, Commissioner Baker, if we can, maybe we can go to the final slide or the next step slide to just bring the presentation to a close. That is slide number 47 for those paying attention that way. And I'll just run through this one. So we're continuing to work with NOAA and the co-managers to revise the plan, as we've stated earlier. It's really unclear about how long that'll take, but we know it's going to take a few months to identify the work. There are some technical issues that staff are working on to double-check conversion calculations between the northern fisheries and state fisheries. We know from that point that when NOAA can give us the sufficiency notice on the plan, that it's an 18-month process for them to take that through. I think that I heard a commissioner talk about the quality of the document now that we've missed the deadline and being ready for the May 2019 fishery. I am looking at this as being submitted sometime after North of Falcon or completed after North of Falcon, and NOAA being able to proceed and having a multi-year plan in place for the May of 2020 fishery. I say that with knowing that we cannot pull our foot off the accelerator. We have to stay diligent in our efforts to complete this with our co-managers. It's a priority for all of us, and I think it's very important to finish this in a high-quality fashion in which we started. And then co-managers need to finalize the management objectives. We talked about this earlier for the 2018 fishery by late February. That's likely the most pressing issue that we'll have, so we have a common understanding of what our constraints and obligations to each other and the citizens of the state and to the resource are going to be as we go through the salmon season setting process starting very, very soon.
Mr. Vice Chairman, question?
Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, thank you to the staff for putting this all together. And we didn't finish every one of the slides. This provides excellent proof for some questions on the 19th. A question on this last bullet, and it did come up as a matter of a policy decision. Should the management objectives for the 2018 fishery structure be the same as we've had, say, last year, or should they be the same as are being proposed in the new plan? Now, the new plan has been asked for some revisions by the National Marine Fisheries Service folks for a couple of stocks, and as the first bullet says, it's under revision. So by late February, it's still going to be there. So I guess this would be a significant policy choice for the department, the commission. What is the management objective for 2018? To stay the course of last year until something else is agreed to, or to try to leap forward and use some of the new principles that are being talked about? We had a North of Falcon briefing scheduled for January that was moved to March because the forecasts aren't out until late February. And by March, they would be out, and that'd be a good time to learn a little bit more about the North of Falcon. At least that was the thinking is in my mind. But what you're saying here in this last bullet is that by late February, this very high-level policy choice of what are the management objectives need to be made. So maybe when we get together on the 19th, we ought to talk at looking at that year at a glance on whether to move that North of Falcon briefing into February.
Commissioner McIsaac, if I can, this is Ron. To partially address your comment question, is that we don't know where we stand right now relative to what the management objectives would be for 2018. We could, it was stated that do you go back to last year? We know that with the analysis in the off season that NOAA has done, that we have trend analysis and stock status updates that say that many of the stocks may need to come down from where they were last year. And we also have questions about the current status of the plan and the management objectives that are outlined there. So still some work to do, whether you go with what we have, what we've had, or something new in a development process in the discussion between co-managers and our NOAA partners. So I think that we have, although we don't have a lot of time, I'm anxious to hear about the conversation and any direction that the commission might have next week that allows us, if we're going to alter a position, to proceed in those discussions in earnest to try to finish them by the tail end of February so that we receive on time our guidance letter from NOAA to the council for us to start to set seasons through the North Falcon process.
Okay. Anything else?
Comment about next week's public presentation. I think it might be helpful. I appreciate, Ron and Steph, that you're working hard to get the NOAA comments up on the website and available for the public. I think it might be useful in the public presentation to kind of have an overview of those and what we can talk about in public in terms of the department's read on what those mean if we move into these next steps.
Commissioner Thornburn, this is Ron. There were pieces of the presentation that we didn't get to that I think could have helped clarify some of that, and we will be prepared to talk in more detail about that topic next Friday. Thank you.
Before I bring this conference call to closure, I just want to visit one item here, and I think the commission got an email this afternoon from George Harris. George Harris is the president of the Northwest Marine Trade Association. an industry association that's larger than the Washington State apple industry, and I won't bore you with it. I was involved in it for 40 years. But this is very, very sympathetic with what's going on out there in the state, affecting the people that we're responsible for, the people that we're supposed to be accountable for. And I just want to make sure that we all on this call realize how important it is we work hard to come up with the right solution. Just to give you an example of the email, for those of you that haven't read it, including staff, for example, there's a lot of carnage going out there already in industry because the customer base is so upset and so nervous that they're no longer purchasing equipment and boats and fishing tackle at the same level that they were. And over where Jay Holzmiller lives, Renaissance Marine, which is located in Clarkston, which is a manufacturer that I was a dealer for many, many years, their sales are and activity are off by 30%. They're laying off 30% of their people, and they're considering relocating their company to the Great Lakes. And if you don't think that boat builder leaving the Clarkson community would cause great heartburn in that area, let me just tell you, for those of you that have never been in business for yourself and never had to worry about making payroll or finding money for the mortgage payments on your building or all the costs that go along with being in business yourself, you don't get it. I'll just tell you, you don't get it. I sold my companies back in the end of March of 2017. And the people that bought my companies are now, because of the cancellations of boat orders and the reductions in activity, anticipate they're going to have a $20 million sales decrease going into 2018. And they're in effect working on laying off a significant number of people. That's very painful to be thinking about, because these are just two relatively small companies in very much rural areas. So I can't emphasize enough that this is about real people and real jobs and people with kids, and we got to find a way to compromise, find a happy medium, and let these people survive into the future and be happy, lucky, taxpaying citizens of the state. So I'm off my soapbox now. Anyone else have any closing comments?
Commissioner Carpenter, this is Ron. I don't know if it's appropriate for staff, but again, I'd like to thank the commission for adjusting your schedules and participating, asking a lot of questions. We look forward to the continued conversation on Friday and executive session to bring this to an advanced decision to move forward. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks to the entire staff and my colleagues on the commission. It's not an easy situation we have at hand, and I think we have to work hard to try and find something that's reasonable and that we can all live with, because it's a grave concern. Okay, if we have no other questions or comments, it's now 4:04 on January the 12th, 2018, and I will bring this conference call to Washington State Commission to closure. Thank you. Have a nice weekend.
Thank you.